welcome to Offensive Shadows,
your weekly visit with a broad, her bud, and the bard.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Danny.
And today is part one of Love's Labor's Lost.
Oh god, I love this play. I love this play so much. It is, sometimes I say it's my favorite play, but yeah, I would go so far as to say it's my favorite of the canon, don't tell the others.
Well, I'm kind of surprised at that, actually, because I thought the play was okay. Actually, I thought it was pretty decent. But there's definitely a few sections that really fell on its face.
Well, it falls on its face to a modern audience because it doesn't really have much of a plot. It's all about sort of rhetorical flourishes that are outdated in our video-centric culture. But remember that Shakespeare's audience is an audio-centric culture. Audience comes from audio. They come to hear a play, not see a play.
It's not just the plot thing, I think, unfortunately. Unlike Comedy of Errors, which I think translates over very well to a modern audience, much of the humor in this play is very dated.
Well, it's based in language, and a lot of it presupposes that the audience has a firm grip of Latin, which we don't. Not even freaks like me, really. So. Not at all.
So before we get into the actual play, what's the history of the play? When was it written? How many different versions do we have out there? We probably won't touch on it this week, but there's a potential that there is a lost play that was a sequel to this play.
Ah, yes. Spoilers.
There's a very sordid history as to the background for this play.
Okay, well, the play may have been initially written as late as 1580s for a performance by an amateur company of boy actors, and it definitely bears similarities in form to some of John Lilly's stuff, and Lilly was a famous playwright who wrote for a boys' company.
And these were the companies that were actually competition for the adult companies?
Yeah, so in early modern England, you would have these companies that were just these young boys, castrati and things like that, and they were performing at the indoor playhouses across the river, and they were very, very popular. So there was sort of this fear that the boy companies would put the adult companies out of business.
Because I'm sure the operating expenses for the boy companies were much less than the adult ones.
Yeah, well, you know, basically slave labor, can't beat it. The play was later revised maybe as late as 1597 or 98, but most scholars date the original composition in 1594 to 1595. The play has no source text that we know of, which makes it pretty unique.
Yeah, it's not one of the historical plays, but it does draw pretty heavily from events at the time or recent historical events from when it was written.
It's probably based on the life of King Henry of Navarre. He established a philosophical academy, and he was accused of withdrawing from life. He became Henry IV of France in 1589. And you'll remember in Comedy of Errors, making war with his heir. We're talking about the same Henry here. The courtiers are named for three of the king's aristocratic contemporaries. Berrune and Dumaine actually served Henry of Navarre. The princess may be based on the French princess Marguerite de Valois, daughter of King Henry II of France, and already the estranged wife of Henry of Navarre when she led a reconciliatory embassy to him in 1578.
So they were already married when he went off on his little philosophical retreat.
Yeah, they were married. He starts this philosophical academy, and then she comes with her court ladies, which, you know, kind of sounds like our play.
It does.
The France's War of Religion, 1562 to 98, was a bloody civil war. You know, we're back with the Protestant-Catholic thing. And Boyer and Mercadet are also characters named from historical figures of that war. So we have some pretty strong historical stuff this play is based on.
But unlike the histories themselves, while there's a good basis in history, it's not actually based on any actual events.
Yeah, we can't really say that this is, you know, the Battle of Bosworth Hill or whatever. It's not like that.
There's no parallels like Agincourt and Henry V.
Right, exactly. We're also talking about a mythic history of another land. Usually the histories are the mythic history of England, not France, of all places.
True, true.
Although Navarre is sort of this this in-between place. It's a land that no longer exists anymore, sort of bordering the Pyrenees, and it was part of the Spanish kingdom and then became part of France later on. So,
well, it was one of those regions that was constantly trading hands over the course of history. For example, like Aquitaine, which fell into English possession for a little while and then fell back into French possession.
Also mentioned in this play, by the way, the king and her, the queen, rather, the princess, let's try that again, the princess come to surrender Aquitaine to the king of Nevers.
Exactly. So we have two regions that historically were changing hands and amongst the various European royal houses.
So as far as your question as to how many editions of this do we have running around, there may have been a lost first quarto, which is what we call a bad quarto.
What do you mean by a bad quarto?
So a bad quarto, we've been over early modern copyright practices, i.e. there were, none. So basically anyone who wanted to could come to a play and either write down the play as it was being performed or go and try and write it from memory after the play. And then publish it, thus making a bad quarto. There's a ton of bad quarters of Hamlet running around. We'll talk about that when we talk about Hamlet. But there's definitely a quarto that predates the quarto we have. So the first quarto of this play, you could say, is the lost bad quarto. There's another quarto printed in 1598, which is the basis for all modern editions, because it's a really good copy of the text. Love's Labors is also printed in the first folio of 1623, which makes some strange alterations from that good quarto. It adds the last line, you that way, we this way, but it also sort of plays with the swapping of characters, most notably at their first meeting, Berune starts flirting with Catherine rather than Rosaline. Now, this is confusing for a modern audience, but it's not in keeping with some of the other stuff from this period. Love swapping kind of happens a lot in these early plays like Romeo and Juliet, Midsummer Night's Dream, Two Gentlemen of Verona. We see a lot of boys falling in and out of love with different girls throughout the course of the play. So,
yeah, in R&J, I mean, Romeo starts chasing after a different woman before he runs into Juliet.
Another Rosaline, actually, yeah. Shakespeare seems to like that name. The first quarto of 1589 declares that the text is newly corrected and augmented, which people use as sort of evidence for this bad quarto running around.
Does the quarto actually say that?
Yes. Yes, it does. We do know that the play was played at court before the queen for the Christmas revels of 1597 or 98. It was also played at Southampton's house to celebrate his release from prison, you know, that whole Essex debacle in 1604. And
what was the Essex debacle?
Oh, the Essex debacle? So, really quickly, because it will be more exciting to talk about this with Richard II, but 1601, there is a rebellion against Queen Elizabeth, run by a couple guys who are really pissed off that she sent them to Ireland, and they try to overthrow the queen. It doesn't go so well. A lot of people wind up in jail, and Southampton is one of them.
And apparently he liked Shakespeare.
Yes. Like I said, we'll get into that with Richard II.
But back on track.
So Love's Labour's Lost draws attention to its unconventional ending, both in its title, which could be Love's Labour's Lost, as in the labors of love are lost, or depending on where you put the apostrophe, Love's Labour is lost. And it's put in different places in the different quartos. And also in Berune's line, our wooing doth not end like an old play. Jack hath not Jill. These ladies' courtesy might well have made our sport a comedy. So Shakespeare pretty much knows what he's doing here.
It is really kind of unusual. I mean, we're jumping to the end here, but nobody actually ends up with anyone at the end of this play, which lends credence to the possibility of the lost play that we mentioned before. It's almost as if this play does beg for a sequel.
And, I mean, we'll get into this later, but nothing actually happens until Act 4.
Yeah.
The play itself has strong ties to A Midsummer Night's Dream in that both plays have no dramatic source, both feature a play within a play, and both make reference to Jack and Jill as a dramatic paradigm. You know, Puck has the line, Jack shall have Jill, not shall go ill.
So, the basic setting of the play is we have King Ferdinand of Navarre, and has called his three men to go on a three-year philosophical sabbatical, as we were saying. Almost like the historical king.
Yeah, and he lays out the rules pretty strongly in this first speech we have for you.
And this is King Ferdinand basically laying down the law to his courtiers as they leave for their sabbatical.
Mm-hmm. Let fame that all hunt after in their lives live registered upon our brazen tombs and then grace us in the disgrace of death. When, spite of cormorant devouring time, the endeavor of this present breath may buy that honor which shall bait his scythe's keen edge and make us heirs to all eternity. Therefore, brave conquerors, for so you are, that war against your own affections and the huge army of the world's desires, our late edict shall strongly stand in force. Navarre shall be the wonder of the world. Our court shall be a little academe, still and contemplative in living art. You three, Beroun, Dumaine, and Longueville, have sworn for 3 years' term to live with me, my fellow scholars, and to keep those statutes that are recorded in this schedule here. Your oaths are passed, and now subscribe your names, that his own hand may strike his honor down that violates the smallest branch herein. If you are armed to do as sworn to do, subscribe to your deep oaths, and keep it too.
So that's how the play opens, like, curtain up that.
Now, what's interesting about this is, while they're staying at a castle, at a retreat, the entire play effectively takes place in the Shakespearean woods, where the rules of the court do not apply.
Right, because of course, immediately after the prince proclaims, you know, no women, all this crazy stuff, Beroun's like, so the French princess who's coming to surrender Aquitaine with her entourage, what are you going to do about that? And Ferdinand's like, oh, crap, I totally forgot.
And this is what we call a plot point.
Yeah, and I mean, you really, in Shakespeare, you just don't make inflexible laws. Inflexible laws are made to be broken. And we're going to see this again in Measure for Measure, a play entirely about inflexible laws. And again, kind of in Merchant of Venice.
And you're almost forced to break them immediately the second you lay them down.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So just words to the wise, if you wind up in a Shakespearean play, don't make inflexible laws. You'll just wound up being forsworn and bad things will happen to you. Just trust me. Navarre is this world away from the court, because when the ladies come, the king won't let them in. So they wind up spending their visit basically outside the doors of Navarre, and the Princess of France is one of my favorite characters in all of Shakespeare. She don't suffer no fools.
No, she's kind of awesome. And just to backtrack a little, to prep for the podcast, we saw the Globe version of the play.
Which, as a weird theater conundrum, I had actually seen live in performance before I got the DVD of. And it held up on the DVD as well as it did in live performance. I was really impressed at how well it translated.
And we'll link to it on the show notes. But I highly encourage that you see this version. There's actually two really good versions of the play. There's the Globe version, and then there's the Branagh version. The Globe version is really interesting because it's done actually at Shakespeare's Globe. Or the Globe that was rebuilt on the location of his original theater. So they are about as traditional as you can get for a Shakespearean play. The stage is traditional. The seating is traditional. You'll see the groundlings all standing around the stage.
They did extend the stage a little bit, and they added this sort of catwalk, which isn't always at the Globe, and that's not completely traditional, but what they do, the theater that they make at the Globe is very, like, they don't use zippers in their costumes. All the fabric is period appropriate. It's very sort of recreationist, and this show is very much in keeping with that aesthetic, with the exception of that thrust stage.
So back to Navarre.
So the princess gets there, and the king's like, welcome. And the princess says, welcome I have not yet. The roof of this court is too high to be yours, and welcome to the wide field, too base to be mine. She's like, yeah, sure, I'll stay in a tent, but don't confuse it with your court. This ain't your court, dude.
Yeah, she's actually making it very clear that they are in the woods.
She and her entourage are from a world much, much colder and more real than Navarre. So they get into this sort of fairy place, and they can do things and be things that they're not allowed to be in their court. Like, they go hunting, and the princess even winds up bringing down a deer. It's very manly and sort of odd that a woman would be able to do that.
There is an interesting role reversal here as they're all in the woods, where all of the women are far more assertive and forceful, whereas the men are very passive in this show, with the possible exception of Beroun.
Yeah, Berun definitely, but he has his work cut out for him. I mean, of the ladies, Rosalind is the thorniest, even thornier than the princess sometimes, I would argue. But the ladies definitely get to be the sort of no, don't woo me, while the men have to go through all sorts of crazy love tricks to get their attention.
Oh, they're jumping through hoops the entire play.
Oh, yeah. It's wonderful. Ladies, take notes.
So that's the background of the play and a little bit of the setup and the setting.
So when you join us next time, we'll talk a little more about the plot, you know, some of the characters, some of the meat of what's really going on here.
Yeah, there are a lot of characters in this play. We're going to have to take this play in some bite-sized chunks. I suspect this is actually going to be a longer collection of podcasts than we've done for some of the other plays.
But you know what? That's okay.
So I think with that said, we will pick up next week with a little bit more of Act One and a little bit more of some of the other characters in the play beyond our four lords and four ladies.
Thanks for listening. Offensive Shadows would like to thank Mr. Matthew Rosevalley for the wonderful music, Mr. Christopher Knowles for our lovely logo art, and the vocal stylings of Mr. Gavin Fishman.
We are now pausing for a quick Google check to make sure we don't completely screw this up.